Chapter 27. Everybody hurried off headlong, as for life or death, to see something else, and say it wasn't worth the trouble. I think the most popular and most crowded site, excepting those of Easter Sunday and Monday, which are open to all classes of people, was the Pope washing the feet of 13 men, representing the 12 apostles, and Judas Iscariot. The place in which this pious office is performed is one of the chapels of St. Peter's, which is gaily decorated for the occasion. The 13 sitting, all of a row, apostrophe on a very high bench, and looking particularly uncomfortable, with the eyes of heaven knows how many English, French, Americans, Swiss, Germans, Russians, Swedes, Norwegians, and other foreigners, nailed to their faces all the time. They are robed in white, and on their heads they wear a stiff white cap, like a large English porter pot, without a handle. Each carries in his hand a nosegay of the size of a fine cauliflower, and two of them, on this occasion, wore spectacles, which, remembering the characters they sustained, I thought a droll appendage to the costume. There was a great eye to character. St. John was represented by a good-looking young man. St. Peter, by a grave-looking old gentleman, with a flowing brown beard. And Judas Iscariot by such an enormous hypocrite, I could not make out, though, whether the expression of his face was real or assumed, that, if he had acted the part to the death, and had gone away and hanged himself, he would have left nothing to be desired. As the two large boxes, appropriated to ladies at this site, were full to the throat, and getting near was hopeless, we posted off, along with a great crowd, to be in time at the table, where the Pope, in person, waits on these 13, and after a prodigious struggle at the Vatican staircase, and several personal conflicts with the Swiss guard, the whole crowd swept into the room. It was a long gallery hung with drapery of white and red, with another great box for ladies who are obliged to dress in black at these ceremonies, and to wear black veils, a royal box for the King of Naples and his party, and the table itself, which, set out like a ball supper, and ornamented with golden figures of the real apostles, was arranged on an elevated platform on one side of the gallery. The counterfeit apostles' knives and forks were laid out on that side of the table which was nearest to the wall, so that they might be stared at again, without let or hindrance. The body of the room was full of male strangers, the crowd immense, the heat very great, and the pressure sometimes frightful. It was at its height when the stream came pouring in from the feet washing, and then there were such shrieks and outcries that a party of Piedmontese dragoons went to the rescue of the Swiss guard and helped them to calm the tumult. The ladies were particularly ferocious in their struggles for places. One lady of my acquaintance was seized round the waist in the ladies' box by a strong matron and hoisted out of her place, and there was another lady in a back row in the same box who improved her position by sticking a large pin into the ladies before her. The gentlemen about me were remarkably anxious to see what was on the table, and one Englishman seemed to have embarked the whole energy of his nature in the determination to discover whether there was any mustard. By Jupiter, there's vinegar. Apostrophe, I heard him say to his friend, after he had stood on tiptoe an immense time, and had been crushed and beaten on all sides. And there's oil. I saw them distinctly, in cruets. Can any gentleman, in front there, see mustard on the table? Sir, will you oblige me? Do you see a mustard pot? Apostrophe, apostrophe, the apostles and Judas appearing on the platform, after much expectation, were marshaled, in line, in front of the table, with Peter at the top, and a good long stare was taken at them by the company, while 12 of them took a long smell at their nosegays, and Judas moving his lips very obtrusively engaged in inward prayer. Then, the Pope, clad in a scarlet robe, and wearing on his head a skull cap of white satin, appeared in the midst of a crowd of cardinals and other dignitaries, and took in his hand a little golden ewer, from which he poured a little water over one of Peter's hands, while one attendant held a golden basin, a second, a fine cloth, a third, Peter's nosegay, which was taken from him during the operation. This His Holiness performed, with considerable expedition, on every man in the line. Judas, I observed, to be particularly overcome by his condescension, and then the whole 13 sat down to dinner. Grace said by the Pope. Peter in the chair. There was white wine, and red wine. And the dinner looked very good. The courses appeared in portions, one for each apostle. And these being presented to the Pope, by cardinals upon their knees, were by him handed to the 13. The manner in which Judas grew more white-livered over his victuals, and languished, with his head on one side, as if he had no appetite, defies all description. Peter was a good, sound, old man, and went in, as the saying is, to win. Apostrophe eating everything that was given him, he got the best. Being first in the row, and saying nothing to anybody. The dishes appeared to be chiefly composed of fish and vegetables. The Pope helped the 13 to wine also, and, during the whole dinner, somebody read something aloud, out of a large book, the Bible, I presume, which nobody could hear, and to which nobody paid the least attention. The cardinals, and other attendants, smiled to each other, from time to time, as if the thing were a great farce, and if they thought so, there is little doubt they were perfectly right. His Holiness did what he had to do, as a sensible man gets through a troublesome ceremony, and seemed very glad, when it was all over. The Pilgrim's Suppers, where lords and ladies waited on the pilgrims, in token of humility, and dried their feet, when they had been well washed by deputy, were very attractive. But, of all the many spectacles of dangerous reliance on outward observances, in themselves mere empty forms, none struck me half so much as the Scala Santa, or Holy Staircase, which I saw several times, but to the greatest advantage, or disadvantage, on Good Friday. This holy staircase is composed of 28 steps, said to have belonged to Pontius Pilate's house, and to be the identical stair on which our Savior trod, in coming down from the judgment seat. Pilgrims ascend it, only on their knees. It is steep, and, at the summit, is a chapel, reported to be full of relics, into which they peep through some iron bars, and then come down again, by one of two side staircases, which are not sacred, and may be walked on. On Good Friday, there were, on a moderate computation, 100 people, slowly shuffling up these stairs, on their knees, at one time, while others, who were going up, or had come down, and a few who had done both, and were going up again for the second time, stood loitering in the porch below, where an old gentleman in a sort of watch-box, rattled a tin canister, with a slit in the top, incessantly, to remind them, that he took the money. The majority were country people, male and female. There were 4 or 5 Jesuit priests, however, and some half-dozen well-dressed women. A whole school of boys, 20 at least, were about halfway up, evidently enjoying it very much. They were all wedged together, pretty closely, but the rest of the company gave the boys as wide a berth as possible, in consequence of their betraying some recklessness in the management of their boots. I never, in my life, saw anything at once so ridiculous, and so unpleasant, as this sight. Ridiculous in the absurd incidents inseparable from it, and unpleasant in its senseless and unmeaning degradation. There are 2 steps to begin with, and then a rather broad landing. The more rigid climbers went along this landing on their knees, as well as up the stairs, and the figures they cut, in their shuffling progress over the level surface, no description can paint. Then, to see them watch their opportunity from the porch, and cut in where there was a place next the wall, and to see one man with an umbrella brought on purpose, for it was a fine day, hoisting himself, unlawfully, from stair to stair, and to observe a demure lady of 55 or so, looking back, every now and then, to assure herself that her legs were properly disposed. There were such odd differences in the speed of different people too. Some got on, as if they were doing a match against time, others stopped to say a prayer on every step. This man touched every stair with his forehead, and kissed it. That man scratched his head all the way. The boys got on brilliantly, and were up and down again before the old lady had accomplished her half dozen stairs. But most of the penitents came down, very sprightly and fresh, as having done a real good substantial deed which it would take a good deal of sin to counterbalance, and the old gentleman in the watchbox was down upon them with his canister, while they were in this humor, I promise you. As if such a progress were not in its nature inevitably droll enough, there lay, on the top of the stairs, a wooden figure on the crucifix, resting on a sort of great iron saucer, so rickety and unsteady, that whenever an enthusiastic person kissed the figure, with more than usual devotion, or threw a coin into the saucer, with more than common readiness, for it served in this respect as a second or supplementary canister, it gave a great leap and rattle, and nearly shook the attendant lamp out, horribly frightening the people further down, and throwing the guilty party into unspeakable embarrassment. On Easter Sunday, as well as on the preceding Thursday, the Pope bestows his benediction on the people, from the balcony in front of St. Peter's. This Easter Sunday was a day so bright and blue, so cloudless, balmy, wonderfully bright, that all the previous bad weather vanished from the recollection in a moment. I had seen the Thursday's benediction dropping damply on some hundreds of umbrellas, but there was not a sparkle then, in all the hundred fountains of Rome such fountains as they are. And on this Sunday morning they were running diamonds. The miles of miserable streets through which we drove, compelled to a certain course by the Pope's dragoons. The Roman police on such occasions were so full of color that nothing in them was capable of wearing a faded aspect. The common people came out in their gayest dresses, the richer people in their smartest vehicles. Cardinals rattled to the church of the poor fishermen in their state carriages. Shabby magnificence flaunted its threadbare liveries and tarnished cocked hats in the sun. And every coach in Rome was put in requisition for the great piazza of St. Peter's. 150,000 people were there at least. Yet there was ample room. How many carriages were there, I don't know. Yet there was room for them too, and to spare. The great steps of the church were densely crowded. There were many of the contadini, from Albano who delight in red, in that part of the square, and the mingling of bright colors, in the crowd was beautiful. Below the steps the troops were ranged. In the magnificent proportions of the place they looked like a bed of flowers. Sulky Romans, lively peasants from the neighboring country, groups of pilgrims from distant parts of Italy, sightseeing foreigners of all nations, made a murmur in the clear air, like so many insects, and high above them all, plashing and bubbling, and making rainbow colors in the light, the two delicious fountains welled and tumbled bountifully. A kind of bright carpet was hung over the front of the balcony, and the sides of the great window were bedecked with crimson drapery. An awning was stretched to, over the top, to screen the old man from the hot rays of the sun. As noon approached, all eyes were turned up to this window. In due time, the chair was seen approaching to the front, with the gigantic fans of peacock's feathers, close behind. The doll within it, for the balcony is very high, then rose up, and stretched out its tiny arms, while all the male spectators in the square uncovered, and some, but not by any means the greater part, kneeled down. The guns upon the ramparts of the castle of St. Angelo proclaimed, Next moment that the benediction was given, drums beat, trumpets sounded, arms clashed, and the great mass below, suddenly breaking into smaller heaps, and scattering here and there in rills, was stirred like party-colored sand. What a bright noon it was, as we rode away. The Tiber was no longer yellow, but blue. There was a blush on the old bridges, that made them fresh and hale again. The Pantheon, with its majestic front, all seamed and furrowed like an old face, had summer light upon its battered walls. Every squalid and desolate hut in the Eternal City bear witness every grim old palace, to the filth and misery of the plebeian neighbor that elbows it, as certain as time has laid its grip on its patrician head. Was fresh and new with some ray of the sun. The very prison in the crowded street, a whirl of carriages and people, had some stray sense of the day, dropping through its chinks and crevices. And dismal prisoners who could not wind their faces round the barricading of the blocked-up windows, stretched out their hands, and clinging to the rusty bars, turned them towards the overflowing street, as if it were a cheerful fire, and could be shared in, that way. But, when the night came on, without a cloud to dim the full moon, what a sight it was to see the great square full once more, and the whole church, from the cross to the ground, lighted with innumerable lanterns, tracing out the architecture, and winking and shining all round the colonnade of the piazza. And what a sense of exultation, joy, delight, it was, when the great bell struck 7:30 on the instant, to behold one bright red mass of fire, soar gallantly from the top of the cupola to the extremest summit of the cross, and the moment it leaped into its place, become the signal of a bursting out of countless lights, as great, and red, and blazing as itself, from every part of the gigantic church, so that every cornice, capital, and smallest ornament of stone, expressed itself in fire. And the black, solid groundwork of the enormous dome seemed to grow transparent as an eggshell. A train of gunpowder, an electric chain, nothing could be fired more suddenly and swiftly than this second illumination. And when we had got away, and gone upon a distant height, and looked towards it 2 hours afterwards, there it still stood, shining and glittering in the calm night like a jewel. Not a line of its proportions wanting, not an angle blunted, not an atom of its radiance lost. The next night, Easter Monday, there was a great display of fireworks from the castle of St. Angelo. We hired a room in an opposite house, and made our way, to our places, in good time, through a dense mob of people choking up the square in front, and all the avenues leading to it, and so loading the bridge by which the castle is approached, that it seemed ready to sink into the rapid Tiber below. There are statues on this bridge, execrable works, and, among them, great vessels full of burning tow were placed, glaring strangely on the faces of the crowd, and not less strangely on the stone counterfeits above them. The show began with a tremendous discharge of cannon, and then, for 20 minutes or half an hour, the whole castle was one incessant sheet of fire, and labyrinth of blazing wheels of every color, size, and speed. While rockets streamed into the sky, not by ones or twos, or scores, but hundreds at a time. The concluding burst, the girandola, was like the blowing up into the air of the whole massive castle, without smoke or dust. And half an hour afterwards, the immense concourse had dispersed. The moon was looking calmly down upon her wrinkled image in the river, and half a dozen men and boys, with bits of lighted candle in their hands, moving here and there, in search of anything worth having, that might have been dropped in the press, had the whole scene to themselves. By way of contrast, we rode out into old ruined Rome, after all this firing and booming, to take our leave of the Colosseum. I had seen it by moonlight, before. I could never get through a day without going back to it, but its tremendous solitude that night is past all telling. The ghostly pillars in the Forum, the triumphal arches of old emperors, those enormous masses of ruins which were once their palaces, the grass-grown mounds that mark the graves of ruined temples, the stones of the Via Sacra, smooth with the tread of feet in ancient Rome. Even these were dimmed, in their transcendent melancholy, by the dark ghost of its bloody holidays, erect and grim, haunting the old scene, despoiled by pillaging popes and fighting princes, but not laid, wringing wild hands of weed, and grass, and bramble, and lamenting to the night in every gap and broken arch the shadow of its awful self, immovable. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.